Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, it's a conversation with Penn computer scientist Michael Kearns. He says it's time to program ethics into the algorithms which gather and interpret data collected from our smartphones. A lot more than privacy is at stake. Also, a new program in Philly will try to identify and mentor high schoolers and others who are interested in becoming teachers. The state's teacher workforce is the least diversified in the country. But to begin, Delaware Democrat Chris Coons was first elected to the U.S. Senate in 2010 to replace the retiring incumbent Ted Coffin. Coons, by all accounts, is a centrist who's well-liked in his home state and known for his propensity to reach across the aisle. He was called the GOP's favorite Democrat in 2018 by Politico, a fact which has doubtless irked the progressive wing of the Democratic Party in Delaware. Indeed, challengers are already declaring their intent to unseat Coons in the primary next year. One of them is 34-year-old Jessica Scorain, and for the next few moments, we'll talk about who she is and the odds she might give Chris Coons a run for his money. Mark Eichmann reports for WHYY from the Delaware desk, and he joins us now for some insight. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mary.
So it's Jessica Scorain's first campaign for office. She's director of business strategy for an interactive marketing firm, but she says she considers her work outside her day job to be most relevant to this campaign.
Yeah, she's a president of the board of directors for the Delaware chapter of Girls, Inc. That's a group that works to help girls become, they say, strong, smart, and bold, according to their mission statement. And so it's that work that she's really drawing on to give her sort of the background and the experience, partly for the need for her to run. She was advocating for Girls, Inc. before state lawmakers a few years ago, and she said that was what inspired her to run. She told me when lawmakers were threatening to cut funding for nonprofit groups like Girls, Inc. to help balance the state budget, she really saw a need to get involved and to run and to have more than just an outside voice advocating to those in elected office, but to be in elected office and help advocating from the inside herself.
And as mentioned earlier, Mark, Chris Coons is very comfortable with reaching across the aisle. And Scorain also says essentially, you know, it was Coons' support for Alex Azar as President Trump's nominee for Secretary of Health and Human Services that also helped make the decision for her.
Yeah. And it's that decision and a number of others sort of like that of Senator Coons voting for Trump nominees that she's really found. She's really found problematic, and the Azar vote was kind of problematic in two ways, and a lot of the other ones were, too. First, because of his background as somebody who has lobbied for big pharmaceutical companies, somebody who opposes abortion rights. So there's kind of like the policy reason that she feels that a Democratic senator like Coons should have voted no on the Secretary of Health and Human Services confirmation. But then it's also Coons' connection to him personally. They knew each other from their time at Yale, and so she points to Coons' yes vote as evidence of Coons being overly comfortable voting with Republicans, especially when he has a personal connection. And that's really been a pillar of Coons' time in the Senate, something he would say he's very proud of being able to form personal relationships with Republicans and with Democrats and really use those relationships to work across the aisle, something he sees as a very positive thing, something progressive like Scorain sees as a very negative thing.
What is her platform?
She's definitely a progressive, so a lot of the progressive ideas we've heard talked about on the presidential primary stage on the Democratic side, she backs. So she's for the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, comprehensive Medicare for All, so mental, dental, vision, and mental health care. She wants free public education from child care through higher education. She supports canceling all student debt, $15 minimum wage, universal paid family leave, and all those similar progressive ideals, legalizing marijuana, and decriminalizing sex work. And so it's sort of the that's also a bit of a difference between her and Coons. He's much more centrist, as he said at the outset, maybe more pragmatic. He was asked about the Green New Deal a few weeks ago and said that it's important to be bold, but it's also there's also a need to be practical at the same time. So what could actually get done is a big what Coons really looks to get behind, things that can actually get done, not just big ideas.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting, Mark, to see whether the success of Scorain's challenge depends on the success of Democratic presidential contenders like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. But, you know, we're a ways away, so we'll stay tuned before trying to draw any conclusions on that.
Right.
I remember when we spoke a while back of then-Senate candidate Carrie Evelyn Harris, a veteran and community activist who challenged incumbent Tom Carper in 2018. Her political position tended toward the left. The primary was expected to be a tight race, but in the end, Mark, Carper beat Harris soundly. Remind us of what happened there.
Yeah, and I think there's some connections too between the Harris and Carper race and this race. So it's kind of a reminder. There was a lot of expectations maybe out of state for this to be a tight race between Delaware Senior Senator Tom Carper and Harris, but I think that was mostly out of state. I think those most familiar with Delaware politics would have been very surprised if Carper was upset. But much like Scorain, Carrie Evelyn Harris, he did push Carper from the left, pushing a progressive platform. She was closely connected to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is now in Congress, and she went up to help her campaign in New York and was hoping to mirror some of that success that Ocasio-Cortez had in New York here in Delaware. She painted Carper as out of touch, as a career politician who was beholden to big corporate donors. And I think we'll see a lot of that in the Scorain campaign, too, sort of painting Coons maybe as a career politician too beholden to the big corporate donors. And much like Carrie Evelyn Harris challenged Carper, I think Scorain will follow the roadmap of criticizing Coons for his adherence to the Delaware way. That's kind of the motto of state politicians.
Which is what?
Who they like to credit the state's small size and how members of both parties can get in the same room and find a solution. And that's the Delaware way, right? We're small enough to just get it all done together. But then candidates like Scorain would look at that from a very different perspective and say it's kind of the way for the good old boys network to protect their own at the expense of voters. And I think it's probably that version of the Delaware way that Scorain will use to attack Coons and his philosophy of trying to work together with Republicans, trying to export the Delaware way to Washington in the negative view that she views the Delaware way.
You know, as a relative political neophyte, she's setting her sights quite high. She's not challenging incumbent Representative Lisa Blunt Rochester. Do we have a sense as to why?
You know, I'm not sure why she's targeted Chris Coons. She's certainly swinging for the fences to go for the top of the ballot here. I think there's some maybe in Delaware who might question why she's not trying for a lower office, you know, like a city council or even a state rep seat. But I think we've seen a trend of candidates who are trying to use their inexperience either in elected office or even running for office. You know, even you look at President Trump, he pointed to that as that's why I'm an outsider. So maybe that's part of the that's part of this trend. I think Scorain will try to use her status as a newcomer, as somebody who's not beholden to, other folks that she's helped campaign with or, all these political donors. I think she's going to use that as well.
Guessing Chris Coons will have the backing of the Democratic Party in Delaware, Mark?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assumption. They obviously haven't endorsed yet, but they endorsed Carper in 2018. I would be stunned if he doesn't have the backing of the Democratic Party.
And Scorain apparently says she will not take campaign donations from corporate PACs. How might this then impact her campaign's financing and then even its success?
Yeah, it will probably have a big impact. It's something, again, going back to the Carrie Evelyn Harris Tom Carper race in 2018. That was Carrie Evelyn Harris's stand too, that she was not going to take the corporate PAC money. And in that race, Carper outspent Harris 10-1 in the campaign. So I think we could see a similar fate for the Scorain campaign. Now, she is by trade in marketing, so you know maybe she has a little bit of a leg up on maybe using online campaigning and marketing to sell herself to voters, that she might be able to spin it a little bit better than Carrie Evelyn Harris was. But I think she'll be grossly outspent.
And it's not just Coons Scarrain at this point in the Democratic primary next year. A perennial candidate, Scott Walker, is no longer a Republican. He's now a Democrat. What does he bring to the table?
Well, Scott Walker is a very he's a very unique candidate, and I think I don't think he'll have much of an impact on either Scarrain or Coons taking votes from either one. He's a very unorthodox, is putting it very, very mildly. You know, from switching back and forth between Republican and Democratic parties, he's very proud of his hand painted campaign signs that he paints and puts up all down I-95 that maybe some people have seen driving through Delaware on I-95. And then 2 years ago, part of his campaign included a live streaming from an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I don't think Walker's really a factor.
Yeah. Well, by all accounts, Chris Coons, he seems to be an enormously popular elected official in Delaware. A poll last year from the University of Delaware shows he had a 73% approval rating from Democrats in Delaware. So, you know, at least at this moment, it is early. But with Coons Scarrain, are we talking about a David versus Goliath campaign here?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a big hill for Scarrain to climb. I talked to her for a couple of minutes last week when she announced, and you know, she seems very smart. She seems to have her beliefs well grounded. But I think it's definitely she's facing a Goliath in Chris Coons. And you know, while Democrats are dominant in Delaware, some have said the real top party is the incumbent party. And I think that's why, you know, it's just so rare for incumbents to lose a primary. And I think it was she's got a lot of work ahead of her, but there is a lot of time. So
sure.
So we'll see.
So again, the primary is in September of next year. Why so late?
That's a good question. I don't know. It's one of those things that's always been that way. Delaware's always had its primary on the second Tuesday after the first Monday in September, and it's just kind of been that way for a long time. There is a movement. There was a bill passed in the state house last year to move the primary to the end of April, which would make it the same day as the presidential primary in presidential years. But that got action in the House, but didn't see any action in the Senate. So maybe that will change. But it always makes for a mad dash to the finish after the primary before the election in November.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we will be revisiting this, Mark. So thanks very much. Glad to have you along. Mark Eichmann is deputy managing editor for WH5Y's Delaware Desk. We'll be talking soon.
Thanks, Mary. Good to talk to you.
All right. You too. Up next on the Radio Times Regional Roundup, we'll talk to Pennsylvania Deputy Education Secretary Noe Ortega about the new initiative to increase teacher diversity in public schools. Stay tuned. This is WHYY in Philadelphia. You are listening to Radio Times, and I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. There are approximately 120,000 teachers in Pennsylvania, and as some seek retirement or jobs in other fields, it's likely the pool of educators will shrink. According to the State Department of Education, the number of people seeking teacher certification has fallen by more than 65% in the last 6 years. And to complicate the picture, Pennsylvania's teacher workforce is the least diverse in the country. 96% of the state's educators are white. A new state program will try to affect change by increasing the number of young people interested in pursuing education as a career, in particular, young people of color. The Philadelphia School District will spearhead the pilot program called Aspire to Educate. And if you have questions or comments, as always, you're welcome to join the conversation. The email is radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Joining us now to fill us in with details is Deputy Education Secretary for the State of Pennsylvania, Noe Ortega. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you so much, Mary. How are you today?
Well, thanks. So, Noe, let's begin by tackling the numbers. Do we have a sense as to why there is so little diversity among Pennsylvania's teachers' workforce across the state?
Sure. And I think it's a number of factors when you think about shortages in general. First, I'd like to point out that the shortage in Pennsylvania is no different from the one that's being experienced in other states across the country. In fact, diversity is a challenge that every single state is facing, especially when you think about the increasing demographics. It's important for this to become a priority. So I just wanted to preface that.
Okay.
In terms of why we're having such trouble attracting teachers of color, a lot of it has to do with regards to some of the supports that are non-existent in some of our schools. You also have when folks are choosing what profession to go into or even enroll in a secondary institution, they're making decisions based on how reflected they see themselves in that particular population. So when you don't see yourself reflected in terms of the population of the school teachers or in institutions of higher education, it sort of does influence your decision in terms of where you want to go and what profession you want to go into. So it's one of those catch-22 type of ideas where the idea of diversifying the workforce is in it of itself a recruitment strategy, mm-hmm. and then beyond that, support mechanisms, et cetera, to attract people.
So Noe, the program will begin as a pilot in Philly, and School Superintendent William Hite has already made diversity among his staff a priority. I believe a third of all new hires are of color, and total staff, 31% of teachers in the district are people of color. And again, you address this a little bit, why it's particularly important in a district in which most kids are of African or Latino descent to have people who are of the same background in front of the classroom. Sharif Almeki is a former Philadelphia teacher who's co-founded the Center for Black Educator Development. He supports what you just said in some of his published comments. And he's also quick to point out that, you know, increased teacher diversity is better for all students, not just students of color. Some insight there?
Yeah, that's correct. And I think that's an important point not to lose track of. The idea that diversity only benefits students of color is really concerning for us because it really is something that's beneficial to all students attending any school in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I think that's really important. There are new things that are benefits that research has shown that happens to students of color who are being taught by teachers of color, which increase their outcomes and their likelihood for social mobility. But there's also sort of the spillover effects, right? The indirect effects that it's having in terms of the way the conversation changes pedagogically within the curriculum when you bring in folks who have different lived experiences and perspectives, right? Mary, I think it's also important to point out that this program does not necessarily want to put out there a premise that the idea of diversification falls in the hands of people who look a certain way, right? So mm-hmm. I think the responsibility of what we call a culturally responsive educator is a responsibility that falls on everyone in the school. And so this program, in addition to recruiting and promoting the profession among candidates of color, which we think is beneficial, it's also promoting the idea that we want to shift the way that we approach education and the competencies needed to be effective in the classroom as well. So there's multiple layers playing out here that are all equally as important.
Let's get to the nuts and bolts of how this program will work. So my understanding is, to start, the Philly School District is going to work to recruit a group of high school seniors who might be interested in teaching as a career. What will the program be looking for in these young people? Which qualities?
Sure. So, of course, you know, what they want to do is to make sure that they reach out to, particularly in this first phase of the work, for folks who are interested in the profession, who have demonstrated some sort of interest through either that's been identified through the selection process or from folks who maybe are currently working with these young potential teacher candidates who are nominating folks to go into the profession. I think first and foremost, it's the interest. Next is the ability to be able to navigate the academics as well, right? So it's no secret that in Pennsylvania, the expectations on teachers and teacher candidates are really high. You know, there's a minimum GPA that you have to go in order to enter any educator program, and folks need to be positioned to not just do that, meet the admissions requirements, but also be able to pass the certifications and assessments that are tied to it. So second to that will be that ability. And third, which is for us to be able to figure out how to cultivate the support system needed for them to take the step if they meet one and not both of the previous criteria. The program is structured to where somebody who's highly motivated to go into the profession has been identified by other educators as a great, strong candidate that our institutional partners in the area along with some of our community organizations, step in to give them that extra leg up to be able to navigate and enter into the program.
So what does that extra leg up look like? Let's take a 17-year-old young woman who's interested. And as so many kids in Philadelphia, you know, they're dealing with poverty. Philadelphia is the biggest, poorest big city in the country. Poverty rated about 24.5%. Higher education feels like it's out of reach for a lot of these young people. So how might this program help?
Sure. And this is, I'm glad you brought up Sharif El-Mekki, but I think this is also something that a lot of our institutional partners do. They're creating this sort of culture around college going for young learners, but also motivation to go into the profession. The idea that these young potential candidates are being identified in an early age, immediately they are paired up with current teachers in the field, college students who are also going through ed prep programs, and immediately providing with a mentor to help them with their personal, professional, and academic trajectory. That's the one clear support. Some of our partners who are going to be working with us are also going to be offering support in terms of helping people prepare for any assessments that they would need to both get into college or before they get into the school of education as well. And so those are some of the few mechanisms that are provided to folks who are selected and show interest.
And what are the pathways to financial support if that's a concern for a young person?
Sure, sure. And one of the great things about this program is that each of our institutional partners, our higher ed partners in the Philadelphia area, have all agreed to make this pathway affordable by, in some cases, providing full coverage of tuition or a reduced tuition for these young learners who are going into the pathway. And we think that that's an extra leg up. All these other opportunities as well, in terms of the ability to go into internships where they're being mentored by more experienced teachers. Some of the institutional partners or community partners that are working with us are also going to provide stipends to young learners who will be going to these programs. So the idea that tuition is not the only cost, but folks also need to have sources to afford all the other things, you know, from books and other resources needed.
Sure. And so seven local colleges and universities are participating. What are some of them?
Sure. So six local colleges and universities are participating in this first wave, and there are others who are going to be identified. We have Drexel University, we have Westchester University, Temple University, we have Arcadia University that's on there, the Cheney University is also in there, Community College of Philadelphia, and Cabrini. And then before you mentioned the Center for Black Educators, Sharif El-Mekki, they'll be participating as well.
All right. We are speaking with Noe Ortega, who is Deputy Secretary of Education for the state of Pennsylvania. And we have this email from John. Teaching seems extremely stressful for little compensation. Do you think that people view teaching as a calling versus as a financially rewarding career? And does this negatively affect the pool of candidates? John, I'm glad you bring this up. According to Penn Live, the average starting teacher salary is about $44,600. Many districts pay below this. And Noe, I know you know this, but technically the minimum starting pay remains, if you can believe it, in Pennsylvania, $18,500, which I know Governor Wolf is trying to change.
Right.
But
yeah.
So if you could address you know, John's point.
And John, I appreciate the question. I think this is a question that's in everyone's mind. I think when we went into this project, we wanted to really reframe the idea of teaching as a profession, a calling that you profess a commitment to learn with young learners and provide them with the pathway and social mobility. So the idea of thinking of teaching as truly a profession where you profess outcomes to students is really important. The transactional piece. Now, I think with many, many careers out there, when you begin to think about the social mobility pathway for the teaching profession, the transactional part becomes a big, big challenge. You know, when we think about a number of professions that are very similar to making change differences, you know, you compensation is something that's clearly important that this administration under Governor Wolf, Secretary Rivera, have been working tirelessly to sort of advocate for, because we know it's an important aspect in terms of recruiting people. I think that to miss the opportunity to use a call like this, not to say that when we talk about the profession of teaching, we really need to talk less about the increase in expectations, the challenges and constraints that seem to be involved in the narrative, and then reframe it in a way that talks about the importance the role that educators play in the life of students. You know, one of the things that we do all the time is truly call this a profession that's a social activist sort of profession to make difference in the lives of students. And those are the things that we want to begin to rethink. But you're right, it is a challenge. And I think one of the big priorities of this initiative is to reframe the narrative around teaching as a profession and really elevate it in the way that it was when I came into the profession as a young individual. And I think most people who are on this listening to the show probably remember the profession being talked about.
Sure. Yeah. And as you referenced earlier, you know, this is an issue across the country and not just in Pennsylvania, where you know, people, the number of people seeking the teacher certification has shrunk by 65%. And, you know, we've seen teachers marching in other states, you know, for better compensation. That is a part of it because, you know, it is a job which requires your heart and soul if you're going to do it right. Correct.
That's correct. That's correct. And I do not want to take away from the conversation about the compensation, because I think it's a very important thing. And then we hope by launching programs such as this that get the kind of attention that's necessary for the profession makes the advocacy for the other part of the conversation around competency that much easier. When people begin to understand that this is something that's important in the lives of young learners, this is what this program was set up to do.
Older adults can also participate in this pilot program. What are the requirements here?
Sure, absolutely. So when we built this program, it was the idea of addressing the shortage of teachers and teachers of color in the state, but in this case, Philadelphia. The secondary part, you know, working with high school students, was kind of our first immediate step in terms of launching the program in January. But we also know that to be immediately effective, we have to look at what we can do for our adults that have some college, no degree, that want to go into the profession. So there's an entry point for those individuals who are looking to participate at that level, but also folks who maybe already have a bachelor's degree. Sort of the post-baccalaureate component of this is equally important. Folks who have been out in the profession and are looking for something new, there's an on-ramp for them to come in here, come into this program. The various institutions are launching different parts of that other piece. And once we've gotten to a point where the recruitment begins, which we're very close to being able to do in terms of a formal way for people to identify themselves as being interested in this program, then it becomes then we begin to sort of connect people with the various institutions of higher education that are offering that particular aspect.
Noe Ortega, what sorts of characteristics are you looking for in non-traditional candidates?
Sure. Well, folks who clearly have a lived experience that young learners would benefit from is really important. I think that aspect is not just tied to diversity, race, and ethnicity background, but also other folks who have something to sort of shape the young learner's experience, first and foremost. Also, somebody who truly understands the role that they can play in a young child's life when they select to come back in there. I mentioned before, the rigor around becoming an educator is something that requires good academic performance. So clearly there would have to be some selection criteria to make sure that folks will meet the admissions requirements for these institutions. But we're working with our institutional partners to identify ways in which we could go out there and identify spaces that have non-traditionally been tapped into to recruit folks, right, into the pipeline.
And then graduates of this pilot program called Aspiring to Educate will be encouraged to come back to Philly to teach?
Absolutely. And we're currently working with the School District of Philadelphia to figure out how we could elevate them as priorities in terms of their preparation for the recruitment process for working in the district. So that's the hope.
Not a requirement, though, right?
Right, right, right. It's a real grow-your-own mentality of idea where we could identify young folks who want to live and continue to work in the community to go into the ed prep programs and then get a leg up in terms of their consideration when they reapply to hold a job in the district.
Will there be a particular focus in trying to recruit young men of color to teaching careers? And I ask because, again, Superintendent of Schools William Hite pointed out earlier this year that in a district where nearly half the kids are African-American, only about 4% of the teachers are black men. And over the last decade, this number has apparently been dropping.
That's correct. And by its very nature, the Center for Black Educators, Sharif El-Mekki, a lot of his work when we initially started talking was around the need to recruit more men of color into the profession. And so this is certainly one of the underlying strategies here, that how well we can do to recruit men to go into the profession at all grade levels. It's a very, very important element of this program. And so one of the things that we're very interested in identifying is learning what strategies were successful in the recruitment of men of color into the profession. So this way we could elevate it across other communities in the Commonwealth.
So, Noe Ortega, you have been involved in education in some form throughout much of your career. Sell us on the career of teaching.
I'm sorry? Say that again.
Sell us on the career of teaching.
Oh, man. So I started off my career as a teacher in the early childhood space, and it's absolutely one of the most rewarding professions that you could ever have. It's challenging, and I don't want to take away from that, but the impact that you have in the life of young learners is incredible. When you truly think about ways to elevate people to be more productive citizens, a lot of that socializations rest in the hands of our teachers and educators, which is why we have to hold them in the high regard that they deserve. I would encourage everybody to consider teaching as a profession or just education in general. There's a number of different ways that you can serve young folks. So I truly have been someone that has aspired to educate and like to encourage other people to do so. And the folks involved in this program, from Secretary Rivera to the governor, to the various institutional partners, everyone seems to subscribe to the same philosophy and knowing that the true pathway to have better and more productive citizens, it rests in our ability to provide them with good educational opportunities.
Noe Ortega, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome.
Noe Ortega is Deputy Secretary of Education for the state of Pennsylvania. And coming up next, as we wrap up our hour of the Radio Times Regional Roundup, we'll talk to Michael Kearns, computer scientist at the University of Pennsylvania, about ethical algorithms. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Suffice it to say, smartphones are an integral part of modern life. For many of us, our devices are companions, providing an endless amount of conversation and entertainment. But are they companions we can trust? Artificial intelligence, which gathers data through our devices, can then use that data to make inferences and decisions about us, whether we get into the college of our choice, are granted a job interview, or parole. Two computer scientists at Penn say it's time to think about encoding human principles into these algorithms to help shape the decisions that are made for us in today's technology-driven world. It's a fascinating argument outlined in The Ethical Algorithm, The Science of Socially Aware Algorithm Design, co-written by Michael Kearns and Aaron Roth. And Michael Kearns joins us in studio today to tell us more. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And again, our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times if you have any questions or comments. So, Michael, let's begin by defining algorithm as it applies to today's world of smartphones and other devices. Back in grade school, it essentially meant a set of rules that you follow to perform math calculations, right?
So I think you can think of an algorithm as the design of a computer program. So a computer program, of course, somebody has to go write, you know, all of the details out in a language like Python. The algorithm is really the logic underlying that program. So it's a recipe, if you like, for performing some basic or possibly computationally difficult task. But a typical example would just be an algorithm for sorting a list of numbers. You know, you're given a bunch of numbers and you want to rearrange them so that they're in ascending order, for example. And so, you know, that's a well-defined computational problem, and there are algorithms for solving that problem.
And a subset of this is something called machine learning. And this is really what we're focusing on?
Right. And so machine learning is different than traditional algorithms like for sorting in the sense that one can think of machine learning as a sort of a form of self-programming. So rather than explicitly telling the computer what to do at every single step, you give it a lot of examples of desired behavior, such as, you know, here are a bunch of loan applications, and here are the ones that defaulted, and here are the ones that paid back. Learn a rule from this data that makes predictions about future applicants and whether they will or will not repay a loan back. And so when you use machine learning, you're not literally writing down the rules that specify who to give a loan or not. You're inferring them from historical data.
But then does the machine learning actually make the decision about whether somebody gets that loan?
That's right. I mean, these days in the modern era, and as you mentioned, as we all generate more and more data about ourselves that can be used both for the intended purposes and maybe other purposes. So, for instance, maybe your social media activity is an input to the decision about whether you to give a, whether to give you a loan or not.
Well, tell us how that would work.
Well, you know, so to give a concrete example, there have been a number of instances in recent years, and I'm sure many of your listeners have seen some of these stories about human resources departments looking at people's social media activity in addition to their formal job application. You know, I go look you up and see what you do on Facebook or what you say on Twitter. And you may not even know this is happening. And of course, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to, you know, transition from humans in the HR department doing this kind of work to pointing an algorithm at that data and incorporating it into your application and using this to, again, try to identify promising or unpromising candidates.
Let's take a closer look at our smartphones. So, and what might be generating data that we are unaware of? Apps, that sort of thing?
Yeah. I mean, in general, I think most people these days seem to have some awareness of the fact that, you know, your phone is some form of surveillance device.
Yeah.
If you're not very careful about the settings, it's, of course, tracking where you are. It's tracking your activity. It's, you know, knows where you are, knows whether you're awake,
which
whether you're
asleep. Which products you like.
Yeah, whether you're walking, whether you're driving. If you're using a navigation app, it knows not only where you are but where you're going. It might know your travel plans. It knows your calendar, et cetera. And so all of this data is on there, and it's just a question of who it's being shared with and how it's being used. But it's very, very common these days to take data of this kind and to use it in the machine learning process to build predictive models for all kinds of things.
Which can then lead to really important decisions like, say, perhaps not getting into the college that you were shooting for. And again, a decision not made by a human being but by the machine learning.
Right. And, you know, I think the rise of the consumer internet and all of this, you know, digital exhaust, as it's sometimes called, that we're spewing off all the time, has made it easier and easier to automate things, right? And there's just many things that happen at such a large scale that it's extremely tempting to automate processes that were once, you know, in the domain of human decision making. So, you know, college admissions is an example. I mean, with applications on the rise everywhere, it's just hard for admissions offices to literally look at the details of every single application. Similarly with mortgage applications and the like. So there are just many decisions where, you know, from a practical standpoint, it is appealing to use algorithms and machine learning in the decision-making pipeline.
Well, before we kind of get into the nuts and bolts of developing ethical algorithms, some of these decisions are also critical in terms of criminal justice processes, whether a person's granted bail or parole. I mean, I'm trying to get my arms around, and everybody, you know, who's listening, about what sorts of data are out there personally that we're really, they're kind of flying under the radar for us that we need to be aware of.
Yeah, so you know, the use of machine learning and statistical prediction methods in criminal sentencing and parole decisions and bail decisions, this has been around for a while. To my knowledge, I still don't believe that these decisions are entirely automated. It would be more typical that a judge receives a risk assessment score that was, you know, the result of a machine learning model's predictions. And in general, I think for the most part, the data that is used in building those models, you know, is relevant to the individual's criminal history. But it does often include a lot of other stuff that you'd find surprising. So, you know, some of these risk assessment tools will look not just at your criminal history, but your employment history. And also things like whether you have a telephone, for example, or, you know, whether you have relatives living in the area. So things that, you know, aren't about your criminal history but might be relevant in, for instance, in the terms of your parole or what kind of supports you have. And so it's not that the data is so unreasonable, but you know, as we describe in our book, it's the process itself that can introduce problems.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the design of the process as it stands now. You say in a Penn Live article, they're often so complex and opaque that even their designers can't anticipate how they'll behave in many situations, which is, I guess, leading to our ethical algorithm. So step one.
Yeah, so that's right. So again, kind of making this contrast between, you know, coding up an algorithm for sorting a list of numbers in which you're literally going to specify every step and then presumably understand every step. A lot of the kind of social misbehavior that creeps into algorithms via machine learning is a byproduct of the learning process. And that learning process is actually quite simple conceptually. It's like I have a bunch of historical data on people that defaulted on loans and people that paid them back. And I want to learn a model. I want to find a model or a rule that basically does a very good job at correctly predicting which ones are going to repay and which ones aren't, okay? And so there's a goal here, right? And that goal is to minimize predictive error, period, right? And so it's the period that's the problem here. Mm. So if I basically tell the computer to find the rule which minimizes predictive error, I shouldn't expect to get anything else for free. So if the rule that minimizes predictive error has a greater false rejection rate on black people than white people, then that's the model that's going to be used, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. so it's not the principles. It's sort of the principles themselves that are the problem here, which is, you know, if I just go for an objective like accuracy and I don't specify anything, let's say, about fairness or about privacy, I'm not going to get those for free.
So then how do you design the quote-unquote ethical piece of this when you are designing an algorithm?
Right. So at a high level, I mean, the devil's in the details, but at a high level, the fix is quite simple. Is instead of just going for predictive accuracy, you need to put constraints on the process. So, you know, instead of finding the rule which does the best job at distinguishing between defaults and repayments, I could say, well, find the rule that is as accurate as possible, but subject to the condition that the false rejection rate on black people and white people can't be too big. It can't be, you know, I could ask that it be 0%, 1%, 10%, which gives me a knob, really, that lets me trade off between accuracy and fairness. But you need to explicitly kind of say, you know, the hard part here is saying what you mean by fairness. Once you settle
on... That's the human, the moral aspect
that
somehow
exactly
you have
right.
to craft. And in crafting this, because human morals can vary from person to person, how do you do this?
So this is the hard part, right? And just to be clear, we are in no way advocating that, you know, algorithms themselves should decide on what fairness means. This is on society. We have to do this as a society, and this is going to be hard. But I think there's real value in being precise about these things because, first of all, you know, by not being precise, it doesn't mean that the problems don't exist, right? You know, this is kind of false thinking to think like, well, if, you know, we shouldn't write down precise definitions of fairness because, you know, what if there's disagreement about them? I mean, you know, these decisions are going to get made one way or another. And you're right. When you start talking about definitions of fairness, first of all, if you just take the example I gave, you know, the false rejection rate between black and white populations can't be too different. You know, well, who says that false rejection rate is sort of the right notion of discrimination? And who decides which group or groups should be protected? And the very hard thing about fairness is that we do know scientifically already that entirely reasonable, desirable definitions of fairness can actually be in conflict with each other. So it really might be, for example, that if you look for the model that minimizes the discrimination between black and white people, that comes at the cost of gender discrimination, for example.
Really?
And so in our view, right, it's important to know these scientific facts and to be as precise as you can about them so that, you know, then the hard part that they, you know, in some sense, this identifies the hard part for society to decide upon, which is these judgment, you know, these value judgments about who to protect and to what extent and why.
Is there a conversation which is starting or robust within the computer science community about this issue?
Yeah, I mean, so you know, the general name for the subfield of AI and machine learning that studies these kinds of issues goes by the acronym of FATE, which stands for Fairness, Accountability, Transparency, and Ethics, which, you know, kind of says a lot but doesn't capture everything still. But, you know, I think Aaron and I are representative of A community of, I would say, several hundred at least, researchers in the AI machine learning community who are thinking about how to design algorithms that are kind of socially better behaved in the first place. And we have quite a bit of traffic in this community with, people from, regulatory agencies, legal scholars, sometimes even, moral philosophers, economists, and the like.
Are there some constraints already in place?
So I think in terms of privacy, we're starting to see the adoption of kind of, algorithms that embed privacy inside the code. I think fairness, we know how to do it, but it's a matter of adopting these methods. And one thing that's hard about this, which I've kind of already alluded to, is you're going to face trade-offs, right? The more fairness I ask for, the less accuracy I may get. And, if you're a company like Google or Facebook, less accuracy in your ad targeting, for instance, this is not some abstract thing. This is going to cost you real revenue, right? And so, both of those companies and all the other big tech companies have very good people working on the underlying science. I'm still waiting for one of them to adopt these constraints into one of their core services. So you definitely see them, kind of dipping their toe in the water on services that, aren't, for instance, one of their main revenue drivers. And I'm kind of hoping that in the next few years we'll see somebody bite the bullet and really kind of say, like, okay, in the interest of, let's say, racial fairness in our ad targeting, we're going to accept less revenue.
Should this be legislated? Can it be legislated?
So we have lots of radical regulatory ideas. So I do think this stuff can be legislated, because once you get to the point where you're talking about the ability to encode social norms in algorithms, by the same token, you can audit algorithms for violations of those social norms. So if, for instance, we decide that in lending, false rejections are a harm, and that we want, the rate of that harm to be equalized across racial groups, not just in principle, but in scientific fact, a regulatory agency given access to a lender's predictive model could audit it and measure the extent to which there is racial discrimination in that model. And I think we are, quickly heading towards an era of greater algorithmic regulation. And I would personally argue for automating as much of that, sort of enforcement as is possible, right? Because, this may sound like a bit of an arms race, algorithms versus algorithms. Yeah. But if you're going to regulate the big tech companies, you can't have sort of a small group of lawyers sitting around sort of trying to catch malfeasance after the fact. You really need to be able to monitor these services in real time. And there's nothing kind of, I think, technically or sort of fundamentally preventing that from a technical standpoint. It really is about, the balance between regulation and the company's legitimate rights to preserve intellectual property. But we think these things can be balanced in a favorable way.
We only have about 30 seconds, but when do you think we will see ethical algorithms in place and widely across the community? How many years?
Yeah, science always runs ahead of practice. I'm hoping within 5 to 10 years. I'd be pleased if it was, a couple of years, but I'm thinking about a 5 to 10 year horizon.
All right. Michael Kearns, fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Kearns is co-author of The Ethical Algorithm, The Science of Socially Aware Algorithm Design. Don't forget to connect with us on social media. Head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Adam Staniszewski. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for Radio Times.